Coming to you from a safe social distance on the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is March 20th, 2020, and this is episode 181. I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we'll be playing the live show we recorded back at Fan Expo from February 15th on politics and pop culture. Scott and I were joined by Andrea and Lisa from the Pop This podcast. Hopefully this is a nice break from the nonstop pandemic coverage, which we'll return to next week. Two other announcements, though, before I throw it over to that. First, as Dr. Bonnie Henry has been reminding us every day, maintaining that social distancing is super important. Scott and I are both at home almost 24/7 these days. I'm basically only getting outside for walks and bike rides to stay sane. I avoid touching anything when I'm out, and I wash my hands thoroughly when I get home. Please make sure you're doing the same. We're all in this together, as they keep saying. Second, as we're trying to avoid getting squirrely in our homes, we've decided to open up our patron Slack to all listeners for the duration of the lockdown. We've created a special COVID-19 channel that's been a great resource for everyone in there to share information and ask questions to one another. Visit legandbootmedia.ca and fill out the form there to request an invite. And with that, let's go over to our Fan Expo live show.
Before we begin, I do want to acknowledge we are on the unceded and traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples, whose land we recognize for the use today.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from Fan Expo at the Vancouver Convention Center, this is Politicoast. Today is February 15th, 2020.
I'm Scott DeLundeboom.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Lisa Christensen.
And I'm Andrea Warner.
Thank you all for joining us up here.
Well, this is very exciting. It's quite a view, I have to say.
Yeah.
Like, it could be, if you didn't know what this was,
I literally,
honestly, this is quite terrifying.
No, I want to know everyone's individual names in the audience. That's what I feel like we're at right now. And then yonder. Just see how people come and want to take a load off as we progress.
Because just to the left here, we can practically see R2-D2 and
Darth Maul.
Darth Maul.
I saw BB-8 rolling
around. BB-8's
rolling around.
And
there goes Captain America.
Captain America, yeah.
I think.
So thanks to Fan
Expo. Thank
you
for your service.
Thanks to Fan Expo for having us. And thanks to you for sitting here in the audience and skipping LeVar Burton and Marina Sirtis, who may be talking at the stage on
who?
The other side of the theater.
Yeah, kidding.
They don't matter.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about politics and pop culture, as I mentioned. The four of us are each going to bring up a different franchise, one of that we hold dear to our heart, and we'll talk about how the politics of it work, and possibly how the politics of the outside world influence that and back and forth. Scott and I have been doing Politicoast for almost 3.5 years, and we've kind of done this once before with a Star Wars holiday special, where I think we ended up talking for 2 or 3 hours about Star Wars.
It was 3 hours by the time we finished.
Cut it for the release.
3 times longer than the show.
Yes.
At least.
We also talked about the flawed military tactics and how no one knows what they're doing in most of the times in Star Wars. But Andrea and Lisa, you run a podcast called Pop This. Maybe let people know what that's about.
Yeah, we have done a weekly podcast called Pop This, where it's two women talking about pop culture for the last 4 years and a little bit.
It feels like it's only been one.
Yes, it feels like it's only been one. But it's been 4+
That's
years,
amazing.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
And so we've talked about everything from Star Wars and Star Trek to The Real Housewives and Gilmore Girls. Everything you can think of, we've tried to cover.
We have really covered a lot of ground, I have to say.
Right. Well, all our shows only exist because of listener support. People who enjoy Politicoast can support us at patreon.com/politicoast. Find us on Twitter at PoliticoastPod. We're also on Instagram and Facebook if you look us up. Where can people find, support, listen to Pop This before we jump in?
You can find us on Twitter at PopPopPopThis, which is, I mean, that's just a long thing.
We'll pop up once you start typing, though.
Yeah. You can email us at popthiscollective@gmail.com. You could find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google
Play. Or on
Play,
Instagram, too.
Instagram, mm-hmm. Anywhere you want.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's just jump right in. The first franchise, I guess, we want to talk about is one that's an actual fictional bureaucracy. People, I think, like to think of bureaucrats as very sad and depressed. And some of those do exist in this world. Andrea, tell us about Parks and Recreation.
So Parks and Recreation is a show that aired on NBC. It starred Amy Poehler, and it lasted 7 seasons. And there was a hard-fought 7 seasons because they were trying to get people interested in a show that takes low-level city government and municipal government seriously, specifically a department branch called Parks and Recreation. And Amy Poehler played Leslie. She's this idealist who is passionate about government, a feminist, and is the kind of like municipal employee that you kind of like you kind of dream of existing in the world to a certain extent. I do think she could like tend towards slight like fascist qualities, but ultimately she's like a feminist and she cares deeply and she inspires people to greatness and really does believe in community. And so one of the things that, I mean, this show throughout its 7 years covers everything from government shutdown to running for office to scandals to self-directed campaigns to impeachment, recall campaigns, evil council people, and ultimately sort of grows up into federal government. And I think like the heart of the show, what it comes down to, there's all sorts of people that work together. They have that thing where it's like chosen family, where frankly, it's both lovely and if you actually think about capitalism, terrifying, in which you end up just feeling like sort of obliged to create family in a workplace so you can tolerate jobs. So that's both good and terrifying. But what is really great about Parks and Rec is that the overwhelming sort of message of it is summed up in season 3, episode 1. We're not just pencil pushers. We are a reflection of the community, and we believe we can strengthen that community. Because in the end, the reason why we're all here is to bring people together, which is a really lovely sentiment. And it is sort of like kind of my weird, maybe naive, hopeful belief every time I go to the ballot box that the people that I'm electing actually care.
So on the other side of the Parks and Rec cast, you have Ron Swanson, who plays, or who is the...
Libertarian,
doesn't believe in government, but ironically works for it and kind of plays that tension.
Well, I like what they do with Ron Swanson because he is sort of this, like... Now we sort of have like a, we've seen sort of like how libertarian can end up sort of as a coded word for lots of other things that aren't great. But what Ron Swanson does is he has capacity to grow and he above all respects people with like strong moral character and ethics. And he also eventually begins to believe in the power of friendship. So this is like a show that's so much more about the sort of politics of friendship even and how we sort of like come together again and build community resources so that ideally the world is a better place, which is, again, very Pollyanna, but I actually kind of believe in that.
So I guess if we see Leslie Knope and Ron Swanson as the two opposite ends, amid this you also have all these other random characters who, I guess, portray the spectrum of politics in Parks and Rec, from the naive, bumbling fool Chris Pratt's character, I can't remember off the top of my head.
Andy. I have to say, I rewatch this show literally all of the time. It's like in my constant rotation of 4 feel-good shows that I return to when I just want to like also play games on my phone and have the television on and not do anything else.
It's like a comfort food.
It's a total comfort food. I mean, there's lots of things that are wrong with it, and I rediscover those all the time, but like the way that we love things is to hold them accountable. And so lots of stuff doesn't really hold up that well, but like it's Parks and Rec, Gilmore Girls, Community. And I mean, I sort of go in and out on like whatever the 4th one is, but I hold these in sort of a constant rotation of shows that I return to that like make me laugh and make me sort of think about the world again and again and again in more deep, in deeper ways.
I was wondering, do you think, are they making fun of, are they celebrating, like where within, you know, as you mentioned, Ian, that, you know, it's low level bureaucracy that we do kind of tend to make fun of.
Sure.
Where do they fall on that?
I think it's, I mean, it's like, it's a show that's like about Mike Schur, the creator or the co-creator. It's his view of the world. And he also does The Good Place.
And The Office. Yeah.
And so... ultimately, all of the things that he's very interested in is the sort of minutiae of ethics and morality, and ultimately sort of exploring what it is to be in the world and make the world a better place. Like, Mike Schur's whole, I think, creative ethos is hope. Yeah. And I think that that's what shines through in this, in Parks and Rec, as well as so many other, you know, products of his creation.
He also seems to have an idea, too, that there are, like, the ordinary people are the heroes.
Yeah, and I like that as well. I mean, it's, no one is, like, I mean, outside of the fact that Leslie can apparently achieve, you know, crocheting like 17 quilts in a single night. Like, I mean, obviously we haven't explored her secret meth addiction, but like she is a very competent, you know, person who, you know, defies laws of time and physics to be able to achieve certain things. And so I think like, but she is an everyday working class person. I mean, she's middle class, but she's a government employee who can either go to work and do nothing, which is what a lot of her coworkers do, or she can go to work and be like the, like basically like make up the work of six people.
Yeah.
Which again, where we get into sort of some of the flaws of this structure, but I don't know. It's a pretty like, it, like the West Wing, how it made everyone want to like go vote. This, the Parks and Rec is like a different world of making you care about.
It's a bit surreal, isn't it? There's a little bit.
Well, I'm glad it's a bit surreal because, yeah, like, yeah. I mean, I don't know that we could sort of stomach just, like, can you imagine just sitting at City Hall all day and, like, the best story out of the last 15 years was when the Courier ran a prank April Fool's Day cover about goats eating the lawn care, and that was, like, Mayor Greger's, like, big environmental achievement. Like, that's, like, that is every day in Parks and Rec's world, is the surreal things that make us sort of appreciate the weirdness in the world.
Yeah, there's go ahead.
So most of the time you think of politics and like capital P politics, you think about what's happening in Washington, what's happening in Ottawa, you know, the really big stuff on the national level, but Parks and Rec's much more local folks. And that's the thing that actually for most people really affects their day-to-day lives.
Yes.
So what does Parks and Rec tell us about the relative importance of focusing on the local issues versus the big questions about who becomes president?
Well, I think, like, you know, that stuff of the minutia of our everyday lives is so vital and so important. And, I mean, when I was in journalism school, people were talking about, like, how you had to go to a small town to go work at a small town newspaper because that's where you actually find out what the heart of the matter is. I mean, to be a little cliche, but that's true. And I think, you know, even when I was younger, I was like, well, I refuse to move to a small town. I grew up in Vancouver. I'm not going to do that. But going to sit in on a meeting of City Hall is a life-changing experience. I really do recommend it for every single person in the world. Or go and sit in on a school board meeting. Or go and sit in on a parks board meeting. Like, this is where things are happening every day that dramatically affect people. Like, everything from, you know, having public washrooms and public water available to people who need it to sort of, like, bigger, higher level stuff. And I think that Parks and Rec shows us what it can look like when people care about their jobs. And I, you know, when Leslie is recalled, she is forced to say, well, I want to do things for the good of the people and the people hate me for this. And we understand why that happens and how that happens. Because I think we see in a lot of big ways how people vote against their own self-interests. And I think that this show really sort of clarified a few things in advance before they sort of came to bigger light in, say, I don't know, the last 5 years.
Yeah, I definitely would recommend going and sitting in on a few council meetings because it's hard to understand just how intense local politics can get until you sit through a public hearing and have 40 angry people yelling that someone's building a building one story taller than theirs beside them.
The rule I've heard is that, like, the smaller the issues, the bigger the egos, and this is why, like, student politics at university is so toxic and terrible, because it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters in some ways, but,
it
like...
It matters, yeah.
It matters when you're there.
Yeah.
That's why you kind of work your way up. By the time you actually get to federal politics, you're bored, because you've been dealing with, like, not even being able to make eye contact with someone in the supermarket, because you have, you know, agreed to let them spend extra money on the playground this year.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is the kind of show, again, it's very idealist, but I think it, I would not be surprised at all if sort of like Legally Blonde inspired young women to go to law school, which it did. I would not be surprised if a show like Parks and Rec inspired a lot of people to get into municipal level government.
But there is also that element of that there's a lot of women at municipal level and people don't treat them really well about that.
100%.
And they're made to look like they're too keen or they're...
Well, this is what Leslie whole time, you know, and she does end up sort of like, you know, hitting up against that over and over and over again. And it's kind of why she's recalled. It's because she's an effective woman. And I think that the show never loses sight of that, which is really critical. It doesn't let anyone get away with ultimately saying, well, you know, feminism isn't that big a deal. It's always at the heart of what she's doing.
Right. Well, I think we'll move on in a second. I think we all agree Parks and Rec is a very good show to watch. Like, I was thinking about it, and you talked about hope being one of the key messages in there. And there are actually a number of shows that explore politics, House of Cards, In the Thick of It, Veep. But a lot of them are very pessimistic.
Yeah, they're very cynical.
West Wing's a little bit different, but a lot of them are cynical. But Parks and Rec is hopeful, and that's nice.
It's very sweet, too. Yeah. There's sweet moments that just make you feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's jump from Pawnee to...
let's go from local bureaucracy to the final frontier bureaucracy as we move on to Star Trek.
Yeah, so Scott, you've been doing some reading and research, and you binged all of Picard up to date this morning.
Four episodes, but caught up on my Picard this morning. I want to talk about Star Trek. This is a show that I've been watching since I was quite young, and for better or worse, had quite a bit of influence, probably better on me.
Where did you start? Like which?
TNG.
Okay.
TNG and then backfilled with the original series, watched all Deep Space Nine, most of Voyager. Still haven't seen Discovery Season 2 yet. That's the one thing I haven't caught up on. But I mostly want to talk about the Next Generation era here, because I think that's the one that most impacts people's perception of Star Trek. And that has to do with the question that I think's been in the tension of a lot of Star Trek episodes and series is, what can we actually achieve utopia? And is that realistic? And is the Federation kind of fooling itself when it considers itself to be a utopia?
Yeah, so Star Trek was written by, or created by Gene Roddenberry, who came to it with a very clear vision of what he wanted, right? He wanted to create the humanist, rationalist, but compassionate future where if the better angels of our nature, to use the term, succeed, we have a global or a galactic society that tries at most of the time to get along, as opposed to go to war.
But it wouldn't be very interesting if we never went to war, which is why Star Trek... quite often, I think mostly to inject drama into it, pokes at the Federation society and whether or not it actually can live up to its ideals.
They always seem to stumble on that prime directive, too. That gets a really, why did you bother writing this? Because you literally never, ever, ever follow through. Do we need to explain what?
So the prime directive.
Tell me about the prime directive, because I'm
ahead,
coming
Lisa.
A little bit blank.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's fine.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The Prime Directive is basically a principle of non-interference, that the Federation shouldn't decide the outcomes of what happens for other species, other cultures, and that it's up to them to develop in their own way.
And as a political rule, it's kind of fascinating. You look at Earth societies and Earth governments, and it's kind of the exact opposite, I think, of the European history in every way.
It is, but it's also... literally impossible for James T. Kirk to arrive on a planet and not say, look, guys, I've got this. This is wrong. Listen to me. Every episode. But yet, they wrote this down, which, is that hopeful or just dumb? I never could.
Well, and they made it not just like something that they tried to aspire to, but like rule number one. And Kirk is like, I don't care. I'm Kirk.
But at the same time, it's also presented problems and gets treated, especially in the later series, quite dogmatically rather than as merely just a moral principle, as a moral absolute. There was a season 2 episode whose title I'm forgetting, where there's this planet with a pre-warp civilization on it that is going to be destroyed by natural causes, and the big moral quandary of the episode is whether or not the Enterprise should intervene to save them. Not expose them to any new technology, not change the path of their culture, except for have it not die out. They ultimately decide to go for it, but
To save them, you mean?
To save them.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But is it because, see, here's the problem, too. Is it because they were cool people that they liked? Because that's not very good.
The didn't really touch on the culture that they were saving so much. It was more just a, is it worth intervening to save a life? And the show treated it as a lot more of a drama than it really should have been because the Prime Directive was taking to such an extreme.
I find Picard is a very interesting captain as opposed to Kirk, who is a bit of a, like, run around and...
Loose cannon, planner. That guy, yeah.
Like, I just rewatched...
Do you think they shape the characters based on the actors playing them?
Probably. Well, when it comes to Patrick Stewart, yes.
Yeah.
It feels like it.
Definitely when it comes to William Shatner, too.
Yeah.
Like, Shatner showed up and he was just like, no. I would bluster here and my penis would get in the way.
Yeah. I'd definitely be screaming a lot right now.
Yeah. I just rewatched the other season, another season two episode from Next Generation, Measure of a Man, which is about whether or not the character Data, who's an android, a robot, has essentially rights. This one character had come and decided, I'm going to take him apart because he's Federation property. We should be able to do what we want. We'll take him apart, rebuild millions of Datas. Every ship will have a android who can help operate. And Picard's immediately like, that's not happening. He's my best friend. He's the great tool asset on the bridge, and I like him. And Data's like, I would not like it, but if I have to, I will.
Yeah, more importantly, Data didn't want to go through with it.
But Data wouldn't even have known.
He was getting transferred, and so he had to be transferred to the station, and so he was like, I don't want to go to this. And so he was brought into the conversation.
Right. So this is about our conversation all the time about what are the rights of an artificial intelligence, right? Yeah.
And so they have this, they actually set up a trial over this. And because of the weird rules of the Federation, Picard takes the one side and the next most senior ranking officer there has to take the other side, which is Riker.
Yeah, so in Star Trek,
Second in command of the Enterprise.
Starfleet does everything. They're basically the government, as far as we can tell.
And the military and...
Yeah. Star Trek really loves trials, too. Don't they love these weird... Trials on a planet, like
Q loves trials.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that in the old original series.
Yeah,
but for such a society where the Federation basically outsources everything to Starfleet, it's super weird that Starfleet doesn't have its own lawyers to do this stuff.
So in this case, it
was
that
UN court or something.
This one, they argued that it was because it's a remote station and the lawyers hadn't gotten there yet, basically. So they had to default to the captain.
Can I ask a quick question, though? Like, this is real basic, and again, real sort of person who has not watched this show. Data, like, it's not like an Adam and Eve situation. Somebody built him. He didn't just arrive allegedly fully formed out of a freaking apple or something. Don't they have, like, a blueprint somewhere? Do they have to physically take him apart? Didn't anyone's just make a little recipe of his parts?
So they basically work around that by saying something magic happened in him that makes him effectively sentient, whereas if you just follow the blueprints again, you don't get that spark.
So they think they can recreate magic like it's a David Blaine special?
So that's not quite it.
The essence, the soul. Where is the soul?
I don't think they ever really addressed that, but what they did to get around the why can't we just create more Datas easily is that his creator was killed and they found Data in the wreckage of a destroyed colony, and his creator didn't write down how he created Data, or if he did, it got destroyed.
But didn't he have an evil twin at some point, too?
That's amazing.
They always have an evil twin. There's always an episode of an evil twin.
So there's a return character called Lore, who's Data's evil twin.
Yeah.
And then in the last Next Generation movie, they introduced Data 0.1.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, so there's magic essence in Data from his creator, and he wanted to make a more humanist, less Jesus-focused
world?
They
don't call it magic.
No.
This
is a science show.
This is science. We should be away from Bible myths.
It's a science show that's not actually about any science or the Prime Directive at all.
Man alive.
Yeah, they just say tachyons a lot to kind of brush over most things.
Yeah.
Isn't it supposed to be more rational?
So
I'm so mad right now.
The good and evil is a recurring thing because I think for the most part, Star Trek tries to admit that there's some moral gray, but then they discover the mirror universe, which comes back in a few different series, which is literally evil universe. And so imagine, like, instead of...
There's a Wario, so it's Mario.
Essentially. So wow. Instead of the Federation, there's the Terran Empire. And instead of the Prime Directive, they're just a colonialist expand and take over things. But what I heard one discussion really referring to this as, and this was on the ethics and culture podcast I'm listening to out of the Ethical Society of St. Louis, they said... What's really the lesson there is that the mirror universe and the main Star Trek universe, the good and bad, are actually just really the result of choices. And it wasn't like everything just went evil in that one. It's individuals had an opportunity to go a lighter, dark path, if we want to talk in Star Wars frames.
Is that true, though? Because in Discovery Season 1, the whole plot revolves around the mirror universe, and they establish that mirror universe humans are biologically different than our universe humans.
So colonized humans are different than non-colonized humans?
Is
it implying a history of trauma influences how you grow?
Like, people were in the mirror universe literally were more photosensitive than people in the real universe, so they couldn't stand bright lights.
Maybe they were more open to genetic engineering people.
Maybe. But what's weird about the mirror universe, yeah, it raises a lot of questions, including one about how human-dominated the Federation really is. Because in the mirror universe, it's identical. They use the same ships, the same technology, with slightly evil or variations of it at times.
More goatees.
Their medical technology is basically there to create pain. But the human... That's a human-centered society that's very imperialistic. Yet in the supposedly pluralistic multi-species Federation... All of their technology, all of their ship design comes out exactly the same as the imperialistic mirror universe, which raises some really awkward questions about whether or not the humans are just calling all the shots in the Federation.
And it really appears that way. Whenever you see a like meeting of the Federation, it's like 90% human. They're like, we're a multicultural society that's like all white.
So yeah. They're all colonizers too.
They just pretend they're not. It's like Canada.
Wow. So much. I'm really just, you know, I understand that I'm the idiot coming to this without knowledge, but I'm still sort of floored that I've got a lot of Star Trek to catch up on, guys. Thanks.
Well, I do wonder from the point of view of writing, when you get a new franchise of Star Trek and you have to set out a whole new, I wonder, are they set with a certain set of laws and rules that they have to follow that are from the beginning, like Starfleet and different things, but then they can create like a different group of people like, oh, I'm tired of Romulans. We can just come up with something new. Like, do they have all that license?
They can create some new stuff, but I'm not sure how often you hang around Star Trek fans, but they are very serious about the canon.
Yeah.
And there would be an intense backlash if they just uprooted a bunch of the established mythos of it.
So they have, there's a certain set to follow.
Yeah, there's, what, probably 15 seasons now of Star Trek? That they have to at least try to be consistent with.
But then there's also the new movies which reset everything and are doing it differently.
Right.
So there's a separate canon now.
Like whenever we discuss, when you say we're going to discuss the you know the politics of franchises,
yeah.
We're at Fan Expo, the politics of fans.
Oh.
Oh, you see, both of you were like, I'm out.
Let's go there.
No, it's complicated. Yeah. I mean, as a, you know, if you are hired as a team to create a new show, mm-hmm. And you would like, as you said, to stray from the canon, and you'd like to, and a canon, it's already all made up anyway. It's
yeah.
So strange that there would, when is it declared like, all right, it's canon, now we'll put it in the box, we'll close it, never can be changed. Like, how does someone navigate that?
It's tough, and we'll get into it probably in the discussion on Star Wars, but it just gets blown up eventually because it becomes so internally inconsistent.
Well, what they did with the movies that started in 2009 with the Chris Pine Captain Kirk movies is they just said, oh, it's an alternate universe. Someone went back in time and changed something. So from now on, we can just go our own way.
And then sometimes they don't even like the new Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis. There was just like, oh, the other Halloween movies didn't exist. So we're just starting with you as if, so this is actually Halloween 2. And you're going, wait a minute, I watched a lot of Halloween movies in the middle, mm-hmm. but they don't count.
I don't think the producers would be gutsy enough to go that route when it comes to Star Trek.
Well, with so many of these franchises, you bring up a good point. With a giant canon well-established, that limits your creativity, right? It limits how many stories. And sometimes there's value to having boundaries because then you have to play within them. But if it's so structured and so limited, you know, maybe it reduces the amount of diversity you can bring in, the amount of different writers you can bring in, different thoughts you can have.
We had to learn that in the new Star Wars movies that you do not mess. Yoda does not burn down the sacred books. That is not going to happen. But
you can't have a very strong woman.
Yes, you cannot. And she is not going to be, she can't just be out there on her own. We have to give her some kind of divinity. Sorry, no, I'm getting into bad territory. you can get into there.
We'll get into it. Yeah. Well, because it's going to be Ian's topic.
Back there,
so.
Yeah. Let's wrap up Star Trek, and then we'll move into the next.
Yeah, there's one thing I wanted to touch on, which was the Section 31 plot lines of Star Trek, which I think we're kind of running out of time for. But we didn't really touch on Deep Space Nine, but I found it really interesting how that show would, more than any of the others, really probed at the question we started off the segment with is the Federation Society a utopia? And, well, when they introduced a secret spy organization accountable to no one that in the final seasons of the show is literally going about committing genocide, it really does raise those questions. But I think we'll have to leave it there because we're running out of time. And maybe
I mean,
the
utopia
next
and genocide sounds like it could be a part two for you guys for next week.
Yeah.
There's lots more we can talk about.
Yeah, I think we definitely need to do a round two of a holiday special this time on Star Trek.
Yeah, and we want to have the premiere on that conversation because he's a big fan.
Yes, I've heard that. But he's got a particular Star Trek franchise that he's a fan
Voyager,
of, right?
Voyager, I believe.
Yeah, Voyager, yeah.
But Lisa, you're bringing a slightly different franchise to the table, but I think it will be more interesting.
No, I think you'll be able to pull a lot of Star Trek and Star Wars.
It's hard because, Andrea has seen some Real Housewives. You've never, I'm assuming neither one of you have watched any Real Housewives at all.
No. But you're well-versed in all of it.
Yeah.
Like, all of this whole panel is really something you're versed in.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of versatile person I am, folks. I can go down in the muck, and then I can go up here in the stars. You just never know where you'll find me. The Real Housewives started out in, I think I was looking it up just this afternoon, 2006. And the very first one was The Real Housewives of the OC, Orange County. And it did actually start as there was a, you probably watched the Housewives drama.
I watched one Housewives episode.
No. The dramatic series, The Housewives.
Oh, no, I actually never did.
Did you not watch?
Weird, right?
No.
I did watch, the Wisteria Lane one where it was
that's what I mean.
But it's not called Housewives.
What? It's called?
It's called something, but I don't remember what it's called.
Just called The Housewives of California. Anyway, what's the real name of it?
I don't remember. That's weird. How did I forget the real name of it? That's fine. Don't worry.
Desperate Housewives. Thank you.
Thanks, Desperate Housewives.
There we are. So they were in California, and then there was this talk that they didn't represent Real Housewives. So then they thought,
They were desperate, guys. Jesus.
Yeah. Wow. And then they created this show, which really, honestly, is not also representational of any.
The Real Housewives are not real?
Well, they are real, but the show,
I mean, half of them aren't housewives.
Not anymore. They were at the beginning.
All of them have, a certain level of wealth, too.
Well, they all did. They're in a gated community. The very first episode called Coda.
Yeah, it's real people.
Real people. So they were found, and we just watched them go about their daily lives like Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, except the minutiae of their daily lives is a lot of small dogs and a lot of cocktail parties.
Yes.
And a lot of backbiting.
Yes.
The opposite of friendship.
Why I love it so. We have six housewives. We get to see all the family dramas, but it's all, a little bit more accentuated. Their lives are a little more interesting. So what will happen is, a certain thread will follow through in the season.
Right.
There will be a particular grudge. Mm-hmm. There will be one person did something particularly bad, and we'll explore that through the episodes. And then every season, there's probably about 10 Housewives franchises at different cities. So not everyone watches.
There was a Real Housewives of Vancouver.
There was, yeah. I don't watch all of them.
Okay.
I can only dedicate myself to so many.
Fair.
So I have watched the OC. but I'm a big fan of The Real Housewives of New York and The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Right.
Those are my two favorites. I dabble in New Jersey and right. Atlanta. I haven't really done Dallas or Potomac.
And so do you see different...
Did you see Potomac?
Yeah, that's another one.
All right.
Yeah.
Just
Washington.
Checking. What? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And so there's obviously different characters, different individuals on each of these shows, but do you see like a different political dynamic between them on the different shows?
Yeah, there's
possibly yeah. more than just the fact they're, you know, a different set, like regionally.
Almost. Yeah, you mean like depending on the city they're
yeah.
in, does it... Yeah, there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of, like, the OC is probably a little less glamorous than, say, New York.
Right.
Where, you know, you're actually very wealthy, and same with Beverly Hills. But I would say, I mean, it depends on how you think of it. I would say the politics of a Housewives franchise is very much like high school. Like, who is the queen bee? You know, who's
right.
trying to, you know, navigate in there? You know, who's got a grudge against who? But isn't that real politics, too?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we've seen certain world leaders governing in ways that we feel are very much like high school.
Well, there was that G7 meeting, I think it was,
yes.
in this last year.
Yes.
Where it turned out Trudeau and Boris Johnson and Merkel, I think, were all like bad-mouthing Trump behind his back.
Because they hot mic.
It was Trudeau and the French.
Yeah,
or it was
yeah.
like a...
Trudeau
booth.
And the French president.
Yeah.
Macron.
Yeah,
Macron.
But I mean, like,
Boris Johnson, Mark Rutte, I think, were the.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Netherlands president, everyone forgets, Prime Minister.
I mean, honestly.
And Princess Anne, did you mention Princess Anne? She
oh,
was
I
there
did
too.
She was there. Yeah.
Yeah, she was all. She
it was literally everyone over in this corner, and Trump was over there.
Literally, if you are a Housewives fan, that was par for the course. That wasn't even weird. That was exactly. Hot mic situation is all that you need. You just need. What you need is a group of housewives. Who have drank too much, have a grudge, stick them in a restaurant, and that's really all you need for an episode. It's very simple.
So is a lot of what's happening, like, politics of minor sort of class differences in terms of wealth as well? Like, are there, like, nouveau riche versus, like, old rich kind of people happening?
There can be. It's a little less about that. It's really more just very petty about who said what about somebody's something. It doesn't really... Like, definitely who they choose to be on the series are definitely... They're more on par with each other.
Okay.
So it makes things a little bit easier. But they do try to add new people, the new bit of spice. I think we're all familiar with Lisa Vanderpump, who runs the two restaurants in Los Angeles. Then she got her own show called Vanderpump Rules.
I admit I am not familiar with
her. You know Vanderpump Rules?
I don't know the show.
It's another reality show. Okay. So that was one of her restaurants, and that's the staff that works there. So that's a whole other universe.
Right, of course.
You know, like a spinoff universe.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so that's been a lot of fun. That's different to me. I like the Housewives. Real politics only really entered in very recently with the 2016 election.
So it did filter in.
It did filter in. We actually had a storyline of one of the characters campaigning for Hillary. We had a lot of that involved. We had an actual episode of the Housewives watching the results coming in.
Oh, yeah?
Which, I'll be honest and say, I was not happy with.
No.
No. I didn't write a letter. But I was like, no, this is my escape. This is the place I go to.
Sorry, I thought you were saying you weren't happy with the results of the U.S. election.
Well... I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
Who do we write a letter to complain to on that one?
But I know that there are real world issues, but they don't really percolate in much.
Right.
Like, we don't really talk about the recession ever.
But people
do,
like, end up sort of going to jail for, like, tax evasion, and, like, there's been, like really sort of, like, right? Like, and people lose, like, their wealth, and then they, like, try to climb back, and, like, other people lose their husbands
yes.
and try to, like... There's,
yeah.
like, there are some interesting things around what
but
it means
more
to
like,
be, like, an
yes.
entrepreneur and the politics of business as well.
Well, one of the housewives of Beverly Hills, Erica Girardi, her husband is the famous lawyer that worked with Aaron Brockovich.
Oh.
Does that name... You
yes.
know that? Yeah,
yes,
okay.
I know who Aaron Brockovich
okay,
is.
Yeah. So that was his kind of claim to fame.
Right.
And he's,
I just say it's nice when a man is known for the woman
right? Yeah, exactly. And you really hit on it. I think it really is just a lot of fun to see women in the focus. And maybe you don't think, maybe a lot of people don't think it's the most feminist of places, but every one of them has a side hustle. Every one of them. They shill it on the shows. We're all comfortable with that. This is work. We're doing work here, everyone. Mm. And just for the very first time this past year was the very first BravoCon, which was like Comic-Con. And you could go and meet your favorite Bravo housewife celebrities and maybe even purchase some statement necklaces from Luann if you wanted.
Do you remember on Happy Endings when they were talking about the rom-com con?
Yes.
Like that feels like that's what
it
we're,
is.
Wow.
It
a
is.
BravoCon.
There was a BravoCon.
That's fascinating.
I'm only going to say I am slightly tempted they might want to go next year.
What city do they hold that
in? It was
in
New York.
In New York, wow.
It was in, but you could meet your favorite, you know, real housewife.
Is it because Andy Cohen's in New York and he just owns Bravo, basically?
Yes, Andy Cohen is the patron saint of all of the wonderful things that Bravo creates. So if you like that show called, was it Down Below? It's about all the people who work on those ships, you know, like the cruise ships. And that's a popular show as well. Well, the Southern Charm, that's just about Southern people getting up to stuff.
So one of the things you asked about on the previous fandom is almost the politics of fans. There's not a Real Housewives booth here. There's not a Bravo booth here.
More's the pity, hey? I would love to come dressed up as one of the housewives.
Which one would you dress as?
Probably Erica Jane.
Okay, cool.
Because she's a performer and she's got a whole... Anyway, yeah. Nice.
Is there like a stigma, do you think, attached within like this community towards that fandom? Because I try to hold to the belief that liking things is good. As long as it's not fascism. Don't like fascism. As I look at the stormtroopers over there.
Liking things is good, but accept fascism.
Yeah.
So... And really getting into something is something wholesome about that. But there can still be this like, oh, you watch reality TV?
You know what's really, I have to say, the part that I have the most fun with the Housewives world is the fandom. There are a lot of podcasts dedicated to Housewives fans that break down the episode. They work a lot with the audience. There is so much audience love, and when I meet another Housewives fan, I just love the shorthand of being able to throw references back and forth, moments that we all remember of, you know, like famous... Like I said, there's always every series, they go on a trip, and generally that is... Remember we were talking about colonialism? They don't travel well.
They don't... Imagine.
They don't fit in with the locals. They come straight on in and take over. It is a scene. And that's all we really want. We want a big scene. We want big drama. And so in terms of the politics, I would say it does skew. I mean, as you said, they're wealthy.
Yeah.
It's what are they wearing? How much work have they had done? I've seen them interviewed. There's no one was putting their hand up going, who hasn't had work done here? Like every hand was down. But we also celebrate that because that's their choice and they're happy. And it's a surreal world with, oddly, I have to say, the most fun fans of all time who are just also extremely ordinary people. I stood in line here in Vancouver 10 years ago, I think it was, to get Bethany Frankel to sign my bottle of Skinny Margarita.
And you still have that on your shelf.
And I still have that on my shelf. And the people I met in the line were amazing. We had so much fun.
All right. Well, with that, I think we can jump to the galaxy far, far away and talk finally about the politics in Star Wars. I have two main things I want to sort of explore. The first one, I think, is maybe the more interesting one. It builds off of like a throwaway line in the new Mandalorian series. And I'm not going to spoil the whole series for you, but... the main character, the Mandalorian, he's standing on Tatooine because every Star Wars set of content has to go to Tatooine, this like desert backwater planet.
And no one ever liked to go there ever. It's weird. Yeah.
And they always make fun of it, and then they're always there. And they're passing some of the locals, the Tusken Raiders, sand people. And one of the people the Mandalorian's with is talking about, oh, we should just shoot them. They're violent, aggressive. He throws some slurs in there, and the Mandalorian says, Tuskens think they're the locals. Everyone else is just trespassing. And it almost brings in this element that the Empire, possibly even the Republic before it, were colonizers of this planet.
Definitely the Republic before.
Yeah.
Because the Republic shows up in episode one to Tatooine, and it's clearly been long established that there's been settlements there. And, well, the Star Wars universe goes back thousands of years, so it's become this mess of
human colonies going
everywhere.
And it wasn't necessarily a whole invasion force came to Tatooine. It was probably more like much of Western North America was, quote-unquote, settled with just more and more white people just arriving and taking the land, especially like here in BC. We started off with the acknowledgement this is unceded territories. And it kind of just gets you to thinking. And what I find really interesting about that throwaway is the Mandalorian is styled as a Western. Mm. And the traditional like Western TV shows is always cowboys versus Indians. Indians are savage, bad people. And this is suddenly flipping that on its head with the main character pointing out they lived here long before any of us came here. Let's maybe just chill. And he even does try to talk to them, which I thought was an interesting change of pace for Star Wars.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I found the Mandalorian to be a little bit dull. For those reasons, the Western is a very dull, good guy style, bad guy style of shoot 'em, ask questions later kind of thing, and I felt like it took us backwards. I don't know. There's some. Well, maybe it's just because I miss Rey. You were right. Why do we have women on shows? But they had a strong woman. Yeah. On The Mandalorian as well. Did you watch any of The Mandalorian?
I haven't watched any of The Mandalorian. I do appreciate, though, that maybe I should check it out if they're going to subvert the sort of like Western ideals and actually challenge colonization through a Western lens. To be fair,
it was like one line
episode. So don't oversell it, is what you're saying. I did enjoy
the series.
Yeah, okay.
It was nice that rather than focusing on the same three families, it's a smaller story in what is a very big universe. And we were talking a bit about canon earlier and how it can constrain, but The Mandalorian's great because it uses the established world and starts to tell new stories, which I'd love to see in Star Trek and a lot of other fandoms.
Yeah, I think we're meant to get a lot more of that too, aren't we? Because the last three movies have done so poorly.
I can't recall what the last thing that was happening with the Kenobi series is. That's apparently in development
trouble.
Well,
right.
So let's dive into this because it touches on the canon question we've been toying around with. I grew up watching a lot of Star Trek and a lot of Star Wars. And once you finish the three movies in the 90s, there wasn't more Star Wars content on film. So there was a little bit of TV content. You don't watch the holiday special. It's awful. I tried
no,
once.
No, no, no. You do watch the holiday special.
And you listen to the album over and over and over again.
But you wonder what happened there, but yeah.
No, no. You
it's
don't
Wookiee
wonder.
Screaming for 3 hours.
Yeah, it should just be watched because it is so terrible. It needs to be experienced just to understand how bad Star Wars could have been had it gone a different route.
I literally wrote an oral history of the Star Wars Christmas album, and it was one of the greatest pleasures of my life to find all the producers who made that music and interview them, and then interview Anthony Daniels about what his experience was like recording it all. It's a wild ride, that album. And I really honestly have never seen the special, even though we have it downloaded at home. I just listen to the record over and over and over again.
That's probably better than just hearing Wookiees yell at each other unsubtitled for an hour.
Yeah, sure,
But we would not have got The Mandalorian without the holiday special, so at least it had gave us that.
There's a direct link?
So Boba Fett, who shows up, who's the like original introduction to Mandalorians, was first introduced in the holiday special.
Right. Oh. Okay.
Because the holiday special came out after A New Hope in like 78 or 79. Before.
Right, okay.
But the thing I could access in the Star Wars universe in the 90s was books. And so I read lots of expanded universe books. I played the video games. And so I had this like world built of what happens after the movies, before the movies a little bit. Some of the before the movies was set aside until George Lucas completed the prequels. And then Disney buys it out and they delete it all. They basically say, all right, we're going to re-edit what canon is. We're going to have these 6 movies that are out, the 3 originals and the 3 prequels, and a couple other properties that existed also get called canon. It's unclear if the holiday special is canon, so we don't know if Life Day is a real thing. But then that gave Disney the freedom to do more, but it also kind of left me going, but you destroyed a chunk of my childhood. I mean, it's still there, and I still enjoyed it.
I could see why they did it, though, because there was some kind of out there stuff in the...
In the books.
In the books. They had clone Palpatines running around, which admittedly now actually seems less insane than it did when it was originally put out there, but like it's... There was a lot of stuff that you couldn't really adapt to the movies.
So is that kind of... Do you think that's the purpose of that crawl at the beginning is just to give you that, here is where... This is the canon.
This is the canon, and this is where we're at.
Yeah, this is where we're at.
So George Lucas did a couple things when he released the first Star Wars, and if you watch any movie from like the late 80s and before, they always had all the credits front-loaded. But he was like, I don't want that. I want to jump straight into my damn movie. And so the only title sequence that appears before Star Wars is like 20th Century Fox, because they're like, no, please, can we at least do Fox? And he's like, okay, we'll do Fox, and then we're going right into the movie.
Right, wow.
And I think because he wanted to, he had this whole vision of like 9 movies in his head, but he hadn't figured it all out. And so they're like, all right, we'll let you do one for now. Start with the most interesting. So he like starts right in the middle. And I think the crawl was probably to help.
Yes, yes.
Put that. The crawl has actually changed over time, too.
I think the crawl was very confusing the first time I saw it, because it said, and you know, episode 4, A New Hope, and I went, did I miss something? Can we stop, just pause for a second here?
Yeah.
But
that wasn't in the original theatrical one, but...
Where it said Episode 4, A New Hope?
Yeah, it was just Star Wars.
Later. Oh, they added that later.
That's one of George Lucas's special edition changes.
Okay, so I guess I'm thinking about that one then. Okay.
And so you get these changes to canon over time, and it's growing again once more, but I once heard it best explained as, how do you deal with the inevitable contradictions between all these different stories? And the way I heard it explained is, the stories in the Star Wars universe are all told from a perspective, so they might miss things or interpret them wrongly. And that's why they contradict, is because they're retellings of this history.
That's a very generous, lens with which to view mistakes. I like that.
Yeah, I think we can view all content through that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
At least.
But we haven't seen Rian Johnson treated to a very caring attitude around that.
Yeah.
Sure haven't.
The politics of the fans, of some of the fans in the new sequel series, it's not been impressive. You know, I... enjoyed to some extent all 3 of the movies, some more than others, but there was something I valued in each of them.
Even this last one?
Yeah.
Really? There's like 1.5 good movies in the new trilogy.
I think the last one tried to do too much and too little, and it could have been better, I'll grant, but I also still think there were some interesting elements in there. You know, we had great performances in it from Adam Driver and Daisy Ridley. Too bad they got buried in the middle of like trying to do 2 movies in one.
I'm still waiting for a really good Adam Driver performance, personally. I've watched Star Wars and Marriage Story.
He was really good in Girls.
Oh, you know, I never watched Girls.
I did.
All right. He's always got only one speed, which is spitting. And I'm like a little over that as an acting technique, like just so infuriated that they're spitting everywhere.
You want him just to be like the sad look? Guy,
quiet no,
guy,
he can be angry, but just keep his saliva in his mouth.
There's a really good, I'm a big fan of heist movies, and there's Steven Soderbergh makes those really good ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did one called Logan Lucky.
Oh, yes, yeah, I've never
good.
Seen that.
And just really, really good. And he's quite good in that.
Yeah, I don't think he spits in that. I was just about to bring it up. And
does he doesn't speak?
Doesn't spit.
Oh, spit. Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I was like, I remember.
All right, I'm going to check that out. Thank you for filing that away.
Yeah, no, that's a real, I like that movie a lot. Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And the weird Dwight Yoakam showing up as a guy, the owner of a prison, was odd. Did you notice that?
No, I missed that
okay.
detail.
Sorry. So I digress.
It was a small digression. So I've watched all the Star Wars films. Mm-hmm. I don't remember them all that well. I know that I'm always the one coming to this as like the least sci-fi fantasy fan.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. But I have watched all the Star Wars films, and we've done all 3 of them on the podcast over the last almost 5 years. I think. Mm-hmm. And so I really enjoyed 1 and 2, and I did not enjoy 3.
The most
recent trilogy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and what's
3 really let me down.
And what's
3 felt like a kick to the groin.
Or 9. 3 or 9.
Well, whatever. Yeah. However you want to call it.
What's weird of the sequel trilogy is On the holiday special, we did record about Star Wars. We talked about how the politics actually works in that universe, because it doesn't really make sense. You have Queen Amidala suddenly becoming a senator just because they're like, we elect our queens, but...
Yeah, queens have term limits, apparently.
At least on Naboo.
Yeah, I was so distracted with all of her different hairdos and things. Honestly, I would like George Lucas to answer to that. Like, what was...
It gives the cosplayers lots to do.
Well, entirely.
And
I mean,
to sell. But...
Has anyone ever... Someone must have counted how many...
Yes, and she's apparently appeared in more costumes once you go into the expanded universe of comics and other things.
Yeah,
as well.
It is wild, because one of the things I noticed in action movies is that whenever there's a villain and he kidnaps a woman, he gives her a new dress. Have you noticed this? Like, always in Bond movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark, any of these movies, they always get a new dress, as if, you know, that whole, I like what you're doing,
but
we could improve it on this.
Well, he always wants to put his own stamp on her.
Yeah, and that's what George Lucas was doing to me, to Natalie Portman, constantly. And I didn't, and so I got distracted. I know that's got nothing to do with the politics of this universe.
I was like, wait, we're not, but that's not the sequel I'm talking, or the prequel. I'm not talking about the prequels. I'm talking about the last three that we've
brought up. I brought up the Naboo.
Sorry. Okay, sorry.
But so in the sequels, in the Force Awakens, they literally blow up with their Starkiller base the entire system of the governance of the New Republic. And then they're like, all right, there's no government. We don't need to worry about that. We have the fascists on one side again and scrappy rebels on the other. And it's like, that government didn't work well, did it?
No.
And not just because they got blown up, but because, like, they literally say in the crawl, they weren't doing anything about this rising threat, and hence Leia had to go off and start a militia.
Yeah.
Well, the Last Jedi starts literally right after The Force Awakens ends, and in the space of a title crawl, the First Order goes from this, you know, ragtag band of upstarts to ruling the entire galaxy.
Well, because they did blow up the head of government.
Yeah,
but isn't
just
it,
the logistics of taking over a galaxy? You know how many planets that sort of means that you need that conquer?
But isn't, like, the whole, like, sort of commentary then, inaction in the face of fascism is the same as siding on the side of the oppressor, and therefore you do need to, like, come to a different understanding of what it means to, you know, be actively supporting marginalized people?
Well, I think you raise a point there. I mean, if the New Republic is so weak that it's not relevant to most people, and it's not making their lives better or worse on most planets, and they're suddenly gone and this other group comes in and says, we're the First Order, we're in charge now. It's like, well, same boss, old as new boss, or new boss, same as old boss. And, you know, getting to your point, people need hope. People need to see support. And that's what parts of it, parts of the rebellion, parts of the resistance are trying to inspire. And I think that's when Star Wars is at its best.
Well, and that's why I think, like, neutrality can only be a possibility after we have agreed that equity and justice is the primary status quo.
I wonder, too, if it was, you know, the sketch comedy duo, the English, Mitchell and Webb?
Yeah.
When they did Are We the Baddies?
Yeah.
I wonder when you're in, you're all of a sudden, oh, come on, are we? I just applied for this job to work on a ship. It sounded like good benefits, you know, and now we're the baddies?
Well, and that's what's really interesting in the new trilogy is you have a stormtrooper take off his helmet and refuse to shoot.
Right, yes.
And then it's his moral arc is kind of a side story in there, but it's really interesting to see him go. And then even in the new movie, in Rise of Skywalker, he meets other people who quit.
Explain they were children kidnapped, too,
which
right?
Which is so, different than the original trilogy, because at the start of A New Hope, Luke is talking about filing an application to the Academy, which means the Empire. Luke was thinking of joining up with the Empire until they torched his house.
Apparently it was the only place you could learn to fly a ship, which was apparently also not true. It's just internally contradictory. We're coming up on an hour, so I think we'll close it off here. Any final thoughts on any of the subjects we've touched on tonight? We'll start at your end of the table, Andrea.
Down with fascism, up with community.
All right. Scott?
I have a lot more to talk about, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to close it off here.
All right. Lisa?
I am intrigued to explore this further. The little political universes on all of these franchises are really fascinating.
Yeah. And my last thought is, I mean, we looked into how the governance system in Star Trek works in the Federation. It also makes no sense. So I think that's my takeaway is sci-fi doesn't actually have a good sense of politics.
The most thing that makes sense is The Real Housewives, really, when you're at the end of the day, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you all for coming. Check out Politicos. Check out Pop This. And check out Fan Expo.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.